Talk given Friday, 4th July, 1975. In order to help our new friend, Mr. Sibley, who is here today with us, let us recount certain basic points in connection with our group meetings. Our concern fundamentally is simply this: to bring the religiousness within each one of us, which distinguishes us as human beings from any other kingdom of nature, to fruition. Our concern is not merely to study in the ordinary intellectual way the different teachings of the religions as such, but to understand how we may utilize them in our daily life in order that we, individual people, are completely transformed. And in this connection, we must bear in mind that the transformation is a transformation of our mode of awareness of our existence. Are we aware of our existence confined to the worldly mode, which is concerned with self, with the comfort, with the well-being, with the safety, with the pleasure, and so on, of the self? That's the usual worldly mode. Or are we concerned with transforming that mood into a mode of awareness which is quite free of all isolative self-consciousness, and which enables the living individual to be the nexus, the focal point through which the energies of transcendence can flow quite freely. This is fundamentally important. Only man on this globe is able to look within himself, to contemplate himself, his future, his life, his death. Only man is able directly to think of, in the first instance, God, or whatever the ultimate reality is, and in the next instance, to become at one and in complete harmony, in line with the way in which, to use a theistic phrase, the will of God works, or the ways in which this transcendent energy, this unknown energy, works. In other words, we are in harmony with life itself, and then only our life as human beings becomes meaningful, purposeful, and has the possibilities of fulfillment in the true sense. Now, this is the sense with which the world as a whole is quite unconcerned. The world is entirely self-centered. It never finds release from immaturity of its own mental state. So this is the transformation with which we are concerned. Are we going to live lives which are ego-centered? Or are we going to grow in understanding, free ourselves from our defilements and limitations and shortcomings, and live in harmony with this life, this universal life which flows? The expression of this harmony for us humans is naturally quite different from the expression of a similar harmony where the other kingdoms of nature are concerned. Let us make no mistake about it. We as a kingdom, as the human kingdom, are by no means superior or inferior from any of the other kingdoms. There is no question of measuring worth. For the human kingdom, so and so means fulfillment. For the other kingdoms, other things mean fulfillment. And it's an interesting fact for those who can penetrate deeply enough into this matter and see the truth for themselves, that the other kingdoms of nature are always in communion with transcendence. They naturally fulfill the laws of their being. We don't. And there's a very good reason for this. It is we humans alone who have the power of option to say yea or to say nay to the purposes of life. The animal kingdom can't do it. The mineral kingdom can't. The plant kingdom can't. Each of these kingdoms of nature just functions entirely according to the laws of its own being, its constitution. It can't help but be that. And the communion, therefore, as expressed through these other kingdoms of nature, is an involuntary communion, whereas we, who have the power to say either yea or nay, have to release something into this world which is utterly different from what the other kingdoms achieve, and voluntarily put ourselves in tune with this transcendent reality. And as and when we do that, in other words, as and when we bring that religiousness in our nature to fulfillment, we have fulfilled the purpose of our existence on this globe. Now this makes all the difference between us as humans and the other kingdoms of nature. This release of the light of individual consciousness from within ourselves, so that we are in fulfillment, always in an enlightened condition. We are never in darkness. We are not, we will not be imprisoned within that shell of the forces of the unconscious, as we call it. You see? Now this does make a difference, doesn't it? So your mode of awareness changes completely from the worldly mode, which is the ordinary mode of the ordinary, ignorant, imperfect person, into the transcendent mode of awareness. And its outward sign and expression is that that person is utterly pure, utterly undefiled, utterly pure morally, utterly clean in mind, devoid of all prejudices, preconceptions, assumptions, biases. His intelligence has come to real fruition. His heart is the heart of love under all circumstances, whatever the conditions may be. You see, these are tremendous things, and these are life's workings through the human kingdom. As you can see straight away, it is only the few who can realize this kind of fruition in perfection. And it is not an achievement on their part. It is the totality, it is life in its wholeness, which comes to fruition through the individual who has so utterly purified himself that he has become unresisting, entirely unresisting, infinitely resilient, and therefore transcendent energy functions freely through him. He is the man who has become God. So now, this is how we try to approach the whole question of religion, the religious life. If one goes deeply enough into this for oneself, one will see that one has to become free of all the laid down doctrines, dogmas, and so on. Not that they are false, but if we blindly accept them with our minds, we miss their innermost truth. We can only interpret a doctrine according to what we ourselves are. And our own minds are conditioned and limited. And therefore, we will invariably distort, in some measure or other, the truth which is hidden inside the laid down doctrine. And a doctrine is laid down in terms of thought and speech. And all our thinking and speaking is confined to our limited condition, to our worldly mode of awareness, of discriminative consciousness, which chooses this as against that, because it is pleasant for oneself, because this is what one's intellect likes, or which makes life comfortable in the world. Now, you see, there are tremendous consequences to understanding these basic points. And today, let us just spend a few moments considering what is it that we really care for. You see, we believe, and quite sincerely, but I suggest not quite accurately, we believe in an ignorant fashion that we do mean business as far as religious living is concerned. But if we do mean business where religious living is concerned, then there is an excellent way of discovering whether that belief, how real that belief is. How do we react the moment we are up against any worldly difficulty, whether it be with regard to health, or property, or status or professional work and earning one's bread and so forth, or one's social relationships and so on. How do we react when any of those present a challenge or a threat to us? And how do we respond, or I should say, react to that threat? Do we not immediately fall back into the worldly outlook straight away? Supposing life in its transcendence presents us with the unpleasant, with something which is fearful, something which might shatter our cherished beliefs, what do we do at once? How do we react at once? We rise up against it. We try to defend ourselves, don't we? We want to preserve and protect that which, as we say, we have learned through experience for years and years, or that which we accept wholeheartedly on authority because it is the authority of the holy ones themselves, the great founders of the religions or great spiritual leaders and teachers. Is not that precisely what we do? But have we ever understood that we do this because what we really care for is self, unconsciously, although we may stoutly deny it consciously? It is selfness which stands in the way at once. This is really, really a serious matter. Something we should brood over very calmly and quietly. We should allow the mind to be still and we should attend to the challenge, the threat, as it is presented to us, without immediately trying to safeguard ourselves. This is fundamentally in terms of the psyche, of the mind. Obviously, if you are crossing the street and a motor car is coming at you at 60 miles an hour, it is your duty, if not good sense, not only good sense, but it is your duty to move out of the way of that car as quickly as possible. I'm not talking of such threats, but of this threat which is offered to our inner life, our conceptions, our feelings. The threat to our feelings is one of the most powerful threats that is presented to us by life in innumerable ways. We humans who live in the developed countries of the world and who therefore have the advantages, as we call them, of universal education and so forth, are so conceited that we have quite forgotten, or we deliberately refuse to face the fact, that we are basically creatures of feeling and not of clear-sighted perception. We react, in other words, like the animal normally reacts. Now, there is nothing wrong for the animal to react as he reacts, because that is the law of his being. He can only live by his feeling. But you and I are different. We have perception, we have understanding, which transcends any sort of perception and understanding that an animal has. We are capable of unselfness. Even an animal, the mother, will sacrifice its own life for the sake of the brood, for the child. An animal will sacrifice its own life. You and I can do that under the stress of the moment, true enough. But unless the stress is sufficiently great and provocative, if it is a small stress, then how do we act? We act quite selfishly. Isn't that the fact? And we act selfishly because we are moved by our feelings. And our feelings are dominated by our pleasure drive. And this is one of the greatest obstacles to religious living. It is not that we want to uphold a standardized religious living. That is not religious living. I said these are obstacles to religious living. It would be perhaps more inclusive and truthful to say that they are obstacles to human flowering out and human fulfillment. Because human fulfillment is fulfillment in all those ways which are not the ways of the self, of selfness. It is the flowering out of the unselfness, which means it is the flowering of the consciousness of us, of we, of all mankind, of the whole world, and not my own separative discriminative consciousness. This is the point. Instead of trying to draw the world unto me possessively, greedily, fearfully, violently, and so forth, I let all the forces of life come into me, allow them to be transformed within my own being because of compassion and of wisdom, and let them flow out again, purified, perfected, a benediction upon my environment. This is the meaning of the religious life. Not just piously conforming to something which has been laid down. That's all an external shell. We all put on clothes suitable for the occasion, suitable for the weather, suitable for the time of year or the country in which we are, and so forth. But when we want to cleanse the body, we take off all our clothes, don't we? Now you see, so, what is it that we really care for? This, each one of us must see for himself by looking into himself. Not any sort of morbid self-introspection, not that sort of introspection, that's all useless. But a clean self-awareness, being intensely awake to what is actually going on in the mind all the time, all 24 hours of the day, every day, but maintaining an inward poise, not condemning oneself, not approving oneself, just observing the fact. And not just observing the fact in order to write down in cold blood, yes, such and such a process was going on in the mind, etc., etc. That's no use either. You can write tomes and tomes. In fact, you'd produce 1,000 tomes in your lifetime if you just observed in that way, which is an absurd way, really, by itself. But as you observe, you understand. And understanding emerges as you take everything that happens. All your observation is absorbed in your psyche without rejection, without grasping, without acceptance, which is grasping. In that free state, then understanding grows, and with it, compassion. Because understanding really, in the religious sense, means wise compassion, compassionate wisdom. That is what understanding really means. And this completely transcends the ordinary understanding which we know of in the terms of a dictionary, intellectual comprehension. Intellectual comprehension is essential, of course. You can't do without it. It's indispensable, true enough. But realize its limitations. Intellectual comprehension goes just thus far. It usually shuts out this absorption into one's own being, into one's own psyche. When you absorb into your own psyche, the eyes of the psyche are closed. And you know, whatsoever happens in the state of love happens with your eyes closed. Which means, I'm speaking metaphorically, which means it happens without acceptance or rejection in terms of the awareness that I am accepting or rejecting another. There is no other. When there is no other in your consciousness, you are naturally in the state of love, which is not sentimentality, which is not a mere emotional disturbance, a mere possessiveness or a passion or anything like that. All that absurdity is out. And the reality of compassion and wisdom is present. Now, have you ever, for instance, thought of one of the deep significances of what is described in the Buddhist texts, for instance, in connection with the enlightenment of the Buddha, where it is stated that after the enlightenment, the Buddha says to himself, "But whom could one teach this to? The world is so full of dust in its eyes, so imprisoned with its desires and its passions and its lusts and so forth, that it won't understand this liberation, this freedom, this fruition." And then he thinks, "I will just rest." But then Brahma Sahampati comes along and entreats him to teach. Now, Brahma, as you all know, is the term for God the Father, the Hindu term for it. Brahma Sahampati. Pati means Lord. You see? Brahma, the overlord. Sahang is together with. Brahma, the Supreme One. The overlord. He comes to the Buddha and entreats him, saying, "There are people with little dust in their eyes. Not all people are completely blind. some who are willing to see, wanting to see, searching for their sakes, for compassion's sake, teach them, or else man will perish spiritually. And then the Buddha agrees to teach. Now, who is this Brahma Sahampati? Is he a gentleman wearing a dhoti and a lovely Gandhi cap or some such thing, who appears floating down from the sky or something, the creator god of the universe? Who is Brahma Sahampati? Consider in this connection what you find in the Old Testament, for instance. The Lord constantly makes his covenant. The covenant is broken by man. But again and again, the Lord makes a new covenant. What is the Lord in this case? The Lord is Yahweh in the original Hebrew. Yahweh represents immanent, the transcendence immanent within yourself. Transcendence and the potentiality which transcendence represents is not outside me at all. As far as I as a living being am concerned for this purpose, it is not outside me. It is the lordliness in me, the supreme overlord of all. Transcendence itself resides in here, in this very body. Resides uncompellingly. That is the supreme lordliness in me. It is that lordliness in me which continuously makes a new covenant, howsoever much I may break the old covenant. This is Brahma Sahampati, the lordliness in one. And this lordliness is not an individual separate from other lords. It is the one universal, transcendent, unknown, unknowable reality, the supreme reality, which is within oneself and which is throughout the universe. The entire universe consists of so many signs which transcendence has written across the face of the deep. This lordliness is Brahma Sahampati, which again and again rouses us to the supreme thing that we are capable of. And so, Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, realized enlightenment. The lordliness within him comes up when he feels that, oh, these foolish people, they'll never understand. It is that lordliness which rises up and says, no, go and teach. It is not that he teaches out of personal ambition, not out of any personal desire that I will save mankind or lead men to liberation and so forth. Oh no, this transcendent, transpersonal, I won't say impersonal, but transpersonal thing within him rises up and he goes and teaches. You see? What then did the Buddha care about? What did he care about? What did he care for? I, Gautama the Buddha? Or did this transcendent compassion and wisdom rise up and manifest in fullness the marvel, the beauty, and the glory which is embodied in the word man. He was the supreme man, the son of man, the son of mind, Manasaputra, the Uttara Puriso, the man who had gone beyond. But the going beyond meant that he, here and now, was the living representative of the perfected Holy One. Now you see, if we care in this way, and we can't care in this way merely consciously, or because our feelings and emotions are aroused and we get inspired by somebody saying it or by our reading it and say, oh, I will be like that. That is self-centered. We have to see these things, understand these things, and produce no desire as a consequence. That I will do it. Because all desire exists only in terms of I. There is no escape from that. This is why desirelessness, total desirelessness, has been one of the supreme teachings of only those two religions, Hinduism and Buddhism. None of the other religions have penetrated into these depths. That is to say, as far as their external presentation is concerned, and done it. These religions have done it obviously straightforwardly. Christianity also has done it. Thy will, O Father, not mine. The only problem with the Christian world is that the Father is conceived of as a separate entity. And this is where the trouble comes. The moment you postulate a separate entity, you have perpetuated the state in which the unity is sundered, and that is the state of sin. The first meaning of the word sin, the sundering or the attempt to sunder the unity of the totality. Jesus was free of any such thing, but he had to use language which the Jews would understand. Therefore, he used the terminology which was prevalent in his time. He talked of Abba, the Father. But Abba, the Father, also has a very much deeper meaning than the ordinary conceptual pictures formed around that word Father. The Ba part means the Son. The Ab is the unknown origin. That is the Father. That which emerged out of the unknown origin. And do remember that all this emergence takes place in our minds, in your mind and my mind. It didn't take place as an event in time and space. This is something which we all forget when we build our theologies, that the entire spiritual world, the entire spiritual cosmos, is inside your brain and my brain. And each of us throws out, projects a particular spiritual cosmos, a particular heaven and earth and hell and the great laws of the spiritual life and of nature and all the rest of it. These are all projections out of the brain of man. See what has happened in the world of science. Up till the end of the last century, we spoke so happily and confidently about the immutable, unalterable laws of nature. 75 years have passed since the beginning of this century, and now the scientific world is seeing that these so-called immutable and unalterable laws of nature, in themselves as such, are not immutable and unalterable, and what is more important, that the laws as presented and propounded by man are projections of his own mind and his particular mental constructs and perceptions. The scientist has woken up to the limitations of his own functioning. And therefore, the new science and the new mathematics which is coming into being is like sheer magic compared with the lovely, comfortable, matter-of-fact science and mathematics of the previous 300-400 years. So you see, this spiritual world, which you'll find in all the religions, God and the archangels and the whole host of the constructive and angelic powers and the whole host of the so-called destructive and demonic powers are all projections out of our own mind. When one sees all that as such, really understands them, not as just so many words, but the whole living content of the reality comes right down into us, then our minds become free of bondage to ideas and conceptions and doctrines and dogmas. You see? And then one lives religiously. One lives with a mind that is completely flexible. That is, not just swinging from this pole to that pole. But it is a mind which knows that there is no such thing as a final truth which is statable or thinkable. The actuality is your own awareness of the immediate moment. That is the only actuality for any one of us. As we are alive, in the actual moment, we are conscious. We are aware. In what manner are we aware? Is it a manner in which we as human beings are wise, compassionate, pure, truthful? Do we represent virtue in the real sense, or are we in conflict within ourselves, fearful, violent, destructive, and so forth? These are the things that we must look into. And then, having looked into them, apply them in every little circumstance that crops up in our everyday life. Because every little circumstance will test us. Supposing we are threatened with loss of status. Supposing we would lose our job if we stood by the truth, by the fact. What would we do? You see? We must be prepared to accept loss, deprivation, illness, ostracism, the loss of friends and the respect of the ordinary people of the world and everything. If they come, all right, let them come. But live religiously. It will be painful. It will be hurtful. It is not pleasant. But just continue to live religiously. Aware in the mode of the immortal and not in the mode of the worldly mortal. And you will find a strange thing happening, that insofar as we absorb the pain and the misfortune and remain religious, which means remain truly human and not allow ourselves to be degraded to the bestial state, fighting back against people and circumstance, then, in a mysterious way, the circumstance itself changes. And the circumstance changes not as a mere change, but the circumstance is transformed into something infinitely better than it ever was before. For good. Don't take this on faith in the sense of blind belief. That's no use to anybody. Blind belief is absolutely no use. You know why? Because the imperfect mind, the defiled mind, will always misinterpret the belief. It will always have a distorted and a troublesome mental construct of the underlying truth. And then oneself naturally makes mistakes. So not blind belief, but keep the mind open. Let it be peaceful. In the midst of the storm, be peaceful. This is important. This is our particular personal responsibility. No one can do it for us. Be poised, watch intensely what is happening, and you understand the truth then. And in that living understanding in the immediate moment, the power, this transcendent power for transformation of everything is released. And this is one of the real signs that one is living religiously.